No helicopters have been procured for me to go to golf course. Thank you.
I've never said he wasn't a great politician. I'm just saying he's a off.
He's listening to an interview.
How'd you play out there today?
Well, I found the conditions challenging. Mostly because there's no grass on the golf course. But there never has been.
I'm thinking about the swag bag, and I had high hopes for the swag bag.
When you got three crevices on the green, your course is trash.
What's happening, folks? Welcome back to the Beltway Golfer Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Dixon. This is episode 78. Keep on trucking along. Didn't put any podcasts out in January, but getting back on track on schedule with a minimum of two per month going forward for the rest of the year. Got a list of folks lined up. Today we sit down with another local gentleman in golf media, independent, Mr. Ryan Ballingy. Ryan lives in Montgomery County. He's a Baltimore guy, but he's been writing and blogging and now running his own outfit called Golf News Net for quite some time, as he talks about for a while. But he's been in golf writing and in golf media for certainly longer than I have, and has been grinding at this for many years, has a nice following on Twitter, and has built something pretty impressive in Golf News Net. He talks about his streaming radio network and his upcoming streaming platform, which is pretty impressive for a guy putting this together essentially from scratch on his own. But Ryan was down at the PGA show in Orlando, as was I just last week. And so we start off our conversation kind of talking about our experiences at the PGA show, what we saw, our thoughts of how it's changed over the years, and just what goes on at the PGA show in Orlando. So this is kind of a kickoff episode, but we also talk about all kinds of stuff, even some local non-golf related sports news. As when we recorded this, the morning after the Baltimore Orioles were sold, the big influx of investment from the Strategic Sports Group into the PGA Tour. And so we kind of hit on a lot of different topics, but it was fun to chat with Ryan for a while, and hope you enjoy the episode. Not much else to go over. January is a pretty quiet month in golf as far as local golf news. Just got out for my first 18 holes just yesterday from recording this, played PBDI, kind of in prep for, I believe, is going to be the next podcast after this one with the superintendent up at PBDI, Chris Nevin. And so it was, and I actually hadn't played the course in a while, but it's in great shape. But not too much else to share. Let's just get to the podcast and our conversation with Ryan, and expect some more fun pods and some bigger projects that we're getting ready to announce coming up this year. So stay tuned. But in the meantime, enjoy our conversation with Ryan, episode 78 of the Beltway Golfer Podcast. Enjoy. All right, we're here with Mr. Ryan Ballingy. How are you, sir?
Doing well, Alex. How are you?
So I appreciate you joining. One of the reasons I wanted to have you on is we're the week after the annual PGA show down in Orlando. You and I didn't connect down there, but I saw you in the media. You were having, I think, a meeting in the media room. Didn't interrupt you, but I saw you down there. So I wanted to, we've met before, but haven't had you on the show. And wanted to talk about a whole bunch of different things, but maybe start off by talking a little bit about the PGA show, giving folks a kind of a glimpse of what happens down there. If anybody with social media, there's so many photos and videos of everyone's kind of experience, and it's people making different reels and so on and so forth. But let's start by how long you've been going down to the PGA show?
I think for the better part of 15 years. I think I mentioned to you, I know I've mentioned other people, I definitely haven't gone all of those years. There were some years where I skipped. I don't remember when or why. I'm pretty sure I know why. I don't think I was doing a whole lot of business with either Golf News Net at that time, or maybe I was with Yahoo predominantly or something along those lines. But really the last 5, 6, 7 years, I mean, I've definitely been going. And obviously we had the interruption with COVID in 21, but predominantly been going for the last 15 years. So I've kind of seen the just before the Great Recession through that piece of it, then through COVID, then the golf boom because of COVID, and seeing all the waves of up and down for this exhibition, this big show that really does bring a lot of people together.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, it's interesting. I've been, I don't know how many times I've been, but I think my first one was probably about 7 years ago or so. But the first one I went to, and where I'm going to go with this is so many people, some kind of like some old heads that have been going for 20, 30 years talk about how huge it was 15, 20 years ago before I ever went. But the first year I went was when TaylorMade was doing their big Got Loft campaign. I don't know if you went to that one, but they literally, I mean, I don't know how many millions of dollars they invested. I don't know how much all this stuff costs. I mean, even this year, Titleist was, I don't know if you'd call it modest, but I mean, an army of people down there in their white lab coats and Titleist and many other OEMs and some of the simulators, they have these huge booths that cost who knows how much money. But that first year when TaylorMade was doing the Got Loft, they basically took over the entire end of the convention center, which is just maybe the most enormous room I personally have ever stepped foot in. And then just to tell the golfing world that we all needed a few more degrees of loft, and then to maybe change that message that the very next year. But it's kind of mind blowing. So over the years, you kind of mentioned, we'll kind of get into all the different, your career in sports journalism and what you got going on. But so when you started going, it was pre Golf News Net. You said you were a writer for Yahoo.
So when I first started going, I think I was running my own personal blog that would have been, there were two at the time. So there was the precursor to what is now Golf News Net was called the GNN blog. I created Golf News Net 21 years ago, basically as a host for my podcast, the 19th Hole Golf Show that I had started in 2002, and wanted to kind of create a little golf media site to go along with it instead of people just coming to listen to the podcast. And I started going, I guess 2007, 2008 was kind of blogging there, was starting to write for SB Nation's Waggle Room. That was their golf blog at the time, RIP to Waggle Room. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of wanted to understand what it was all about. I mean, we were starting to do a little bit of equipment. I've always kind of focused more on professional golf and tour golf and that kind of thing in my writing and in my work. But I just kind of wanted to see what all the fuss was about. And it really did kind of live up to it. And, you know, as I've mentioned, the show has gone through ups and downs over the years. I mean, a couple of years ago in 2022 was probably the saddest I've ever been at a golf thing. I mean, just the lack of people there, and just kind of felt like a fraught moment for golf in terms of a professional environment having something like this, because so many people have figured out a way to do their business virtually. That would you ever need something like this again? And, you know, to kind of go from at the time I first went, that everything was hunky dory. You know, lots of people were making money. House values were up. Everybody had equity in their house, and interest rates were kind of low, but not that low yet. And, you know, then it all falls apart. Golf courses start closing en masse. There's this wonder about what's the value of an investment to a trade show. I mean, as you mentioned, some of the big OEMs, TaylorMade's not there anymore. They used to spend a good seven-figure chunk of money between how much they exhibited at the show and booth space, and that's not cheap. And the people they flew in to stand around and be in the booth and talk to people for 3-4 days. Right. And, you know, some of those companies have to kind of either scale back their investment, but then Callaway came back. Titleist stuck with it. Cobra's been a part of it. Bridgestone's been a part of it. And they're kind of the anchors of a show that isn't exactly the same as what it was. I mean, there aren't these massive hundreds of thousands of dollars upscale presentations at night anymore. That stuff has kind of gone by the wayside. Some of the parties that used to exist that were just six-figure lighting money on fire, those aren't really there anymore. But the gathering this year, I thought, was as strong as it's been in probably 10 years at this show. So there's some room for encouragement, some reason to be happy about where things might be professionally.
Yeah, I got that feedback from some people I spoke to as well, that this year's show definitely seemed to be bounced back quite a bit. I was at that same one you mentioned in 2022, and what was interesting about that, obviously COVID was a huge part of that but also the industry, like you said, kind of adjusting the way business is done now, since, you know, most PGA Tour pro shops and pros, club pros have already placed their orders. Where back in the day, this show was, this is where you did that. But what was interesting about that was in 2022, that was 2 years after COVID. And so the golf boom was underway. And so I remember going thinking that the show was going to be back, you know, bigger than ever, you know, bigger than I've ever seen. And it really wasn't, but it certainly seems to be heading that direction. Yeah. I don't keep track of the OEMs quite as much as some other folks, since I'm not a total gearhead and I don't really do equipment reviews and that sort of stuff. But I didn't realize it had been that long since TaylorMade had been there. But I was talking to one pro at the show on the show floor this year, and I guess it's been like since 2019 or 2018 that since TaylorMade was there last, which is kind of interesting. And, you know, they seem to be doing.
Yeah, they've kind of made the choice that they can get their investment better spread out, whether that's working with the four-play guys or other influencers or using different means of attracting a customer instead of worrying about, frankly, a network of not guaranteed customers, but pretty close to guaranteed customers in PGA professionals and pro shops and brick and mortar shops and those people that already have these relationships and contracts. Why are you spending money on that when you can go and acquire customers in a different fashion? So, I mean, from a financial perspective, I completely understand why they have skewed the show and just said, nah, we don't need any part of this. I feel like that's been an opportunity for a couple of different brands who want to align themselves with the professional side of the industry, a Titleist, a Callaway, to say, yeah, they're not here, but guess what? We are, and we support you, and we support the show. Take that for what it is. And I don't know what that means to them or to the people who might be buying from them, but I think different strokes for different folks kind of thing.
Sure. What about at this year's show? I mean, I know you were down there doing a lot of meetings and that sort of thing, but anything that you saw that interest you on the show floor, going by some booths, whether, you know, small companies, big companies, whatever, anything that jumped out at you?
I mean, a lot of the meetings that I do, it's a mixture of things. Some of it's business development. Some of it this year is about, as I think we may get into a little bit later, we've got a TV network or a streaming TV network coming. Just trying to kind of sew up and secure partnerships and talk with people in person that we've been having these conversations over Zoom or on the phone. And then some of it is just still purely going to the show floor, go see something cool. And some of that is represented by friends of mine in the industry. I mean, I love True Linkswear. They're great. They make great clothing, great apparel. It's extremely comfortable. Keeps getting better. Jason Moore is a guy I really respect and appreciate. And we have good conversations, whether it's about product or just life. The guys at Swanee's, that I met them 7 years ago, I believe, and they came to the show with a contraband backpack with the no booth. They came in an RV they had rented, and they showed up to show people their golf sandals. And I remember meeting with them. It was probably one of the few people that did, and just said to them at the time, if there's anything I could ever do to help support you, if there's anything I can do to help you grow on your journey, please let me know. I'll try to do my best. And 7 years later, they're huge. I mean, they've grown so much, and our paths kind of track in different ways. I mean, obviously on the media side, they're on an apparel side, but we get together every year for probably 15, 20 minutes on the back end of Thursday, or maybe sometime late on Wednesday, and just kind of talk. And it's some of my favorite minutes of the year, not just at that show, but period, just to kind of look back and go, how the hell did we make it? How the hell are we here? How did it all work out? And then to see them grow and their team grow from four people to 30, 35 people is wild to me. So I always I always make the time for that. But also just to see people who put their savings on the line, put their money on the line. Like I said, it's not cheap to have a booth at the show. And we talked about the multi-million-dollar spends from the big OEMs, but it's still a $20,000, $25,000 investment if you are someone who has an 8x10, let's call it a 10x10. I don't know the exact measurements, but let's call it a 10x10 booth at the show. And to have the guts to show up with a product or an idea or service and just kind of go from there and see if you can sink or swim in this massive 1 million square foot environment, I think is fascinating. And some people do, a lot of people don't. But a lot, I always wind up finding someone like a Kavua Golf, a kid named Dylan, who decided to invent this training tool because he had a fundamental need for it. His parents were sick and tired of holding an alignment stick in his head. And so he invented effectively a training tool that allowed him to set up his alignment sticks for different drills as he wanted. Brilliant idea. Found an investor. He's off and running. He's doing stuff that we couldn't do if we invented a product 10 years ago, where you could have it sourced by Alibaba. You can have it made there. You can have it shipped to an Amazon logistics facility that will drop ship everything for you and take care of all of that for you for a fee. Those things, we couldn't have done that 10 years ago. I love that a 20-year-old kid decided, you know what? I'm going to do that. Companies that did work out, like Golf Genius. I remember meeting Golf Genius. I don't remember how many years ago it was of the show. I had not heard of them, had no idea what they were doing. Sat with them, was like, what exactly are you doing? And then the founder at the time, at the time, sat down with me and talked me through. I was like, this is, I mean, no pun, this is genius. This is a great idea. And now they're everywhere. You don't play in a golf tournament without Golf Genius anymore. So to see some success stories kind of play out over the long haul is also a great part of the show.
Yeah. I didn't realize that was kind of the minimum investment for $25,000 to get in. And, that's a huge risk for small companies. I mean, there's a local guy who's got a great training tool. He was on the podcast, Mike Dixon, who's a PGA Master professional out at Little Bennett in Montgomery County. And he's got the Lagmaster. And, he was out there and he's got a couple new products. He's got kind of a foldable kind of a swing system that we can stay on plane, but he won one of the best new products. So, I think I just saw on social media today, he's already gotten in a couple of real retail locations. So it's a big swing, a big swing for some of these small guys, but it's interesting that even your story about Swanee's, I didn't realize they started out as just with a sandal. That's pretty impressive. Cause I did stop by their booth this year and they have an army of sales reps, and they had a pretty impressive booth.
Yeah, I think we just kind of assume that maybe the consumer does, but I think we just kind of assume it's going to work out. Like a brand is big at the start and they are who they are, and you don't see the groundswell to get you there, whether that's raising money or making bad product to figure out how to make good product or sourcing. Or, I mean, there's all kinds of different things that I don't think people see that go into, 7 years later, 6 years later, doing really well, whether it's Swanee's or anybody else. And that's what always attracts me to some brand is I like kind of seeing the beginning. I like kind of seeing the wheels turning and what that manifests itself as in terms of product. And you never know. And I mean, I know now, having done the show a lot of years, you never know who you're going to meet or what they're going to turn into. And they don't know the same about you. Right. But if you form a relationship and a genuine interest in one another, then over the years that can turn into something really valuable and fruitful. And I don't mean just in a financial sense. I mean in a legitimate relationship sense. I mean, a lot of my best friends in the golf industry are because of the PGA show. And that, frankly, is the biggest reason why I go. It's great to see entrepreneurship at work. It's great to do business deals and stuff down there. But the biggest reason I come to this show year after year is to see people I wouldn't otherwise see, because life, it's those relationships that really make it.
That's cool. And I had a few, I went down there. I mean, you're trying to secure sponsorships for Golf News Net. I was doing a little bit of that, but I was also down there. I'm at a point now where, to your point, it's networking as much as anything. And so going down there, I mean, there were moments even this year where I'm just, I think I did over 30,000 steps on Wednesday, and I'm just walking back and forth on the floor. And it's so overwhelming. My ADD is kind of going, working overtime, but I did have some conversations with some people like, what are you doing down here? And the reality is, I run into about half the people I've had on this podcast. I'll run them on the show floor, and I'll meet all kinds of new people that, are building relationships even just in this area and beyond. So it's a tremendous, it can be overwhelming, but it's a tremendous networking opportunity for the industry. So why don't we get into that a little bit? So you talked about Golf News Net. So when did you, why don't you, for folks that aren't familiar, why don't you give the elevator pitch of what Golf News Net is, and when you started it and why?
So Golf News Net, as it's known today, started about 12 years ago. I had this website, golfnewsnet.com. Well, it still is thegolfnewsnet.com, but we own golfnewsnet.com now.
Okay.
And I started it 12 years ago when I was sitting in the media center at the AT&T National, which it was at the time, here in the local area. And I got the word from Golf Channel that my time was ending with them.
Okay.
And that variety, basically I was NBC's golf guy, and Comcast didn't need a golf guy. They had lots of golf guys and women. They didn't need just one person to write a blog anymore. And they wanted my boss at the time, Jay Coffin, who saw the show and we're good friends now, but at the time it hurt. And he basically fired me to bring on Ryan Lavner from Golf Week, who he knew in a previous work relationship. And I mean, 12 years later, it couldn't have worked out better for everybody. I mean, Lav is great. His great job. He's a cornerstone of Golf Channel's coverage digitally, sometimes on TV too. And I went in a different direction. It took me a while to get there, but so I started that day in the media center, just started pumping out articles. I was breaking the story of who was going to be the new title sponsor for what was then the Nationwide Tour. And Golf Channel told me I couldn't put it on their website because they had a relationship with the tour and they wanted to announce it first. The tour came to me and the media center said I couldn't publish it with Golf Channel because they wanted to announce it first. I said, well, then I'll just put it on my own website. And that's kind of how it started.
Did you have a website at that point?
I did. Yeah. It was just a very basic WordPress blog. You know, it's still run on WordPress, but it was out there and just kind of started putting my content out there. And along the way, hooked up with Back Nine Network, was there managing editor for 9, 10, 12 months somewhere in there. Learned a lot about what to do and what not to do when starting a media business. And then that fell apart and I wound up hooking up with Yahoo. And that happened amid me working with Billy Casper Golf. They wanted to get into a media venture around covering their courses and been acquaintances with Kyle Ragsdale over there for a long time. And he had a good idea and we tried to execute it and kind of hard to do in a big company. And then wound up moving to Yahoo for 3 years, basically, running their golf blog, which was known as Devil Ball Golf at the time.
Okay.
And along the way, kind of said to them the whole time, look, I want to build my own thing. I want to build Golf Newsnet into something that I can run on my own. And they were gracious and wonderful about it. Said, hey, so long as your work that you do for us doesn't get in the way of the work you're doing for yourself, we don't care. And they kind of let me just work slowly, build it up, little by little over time. And then in 2017, they got purchased by Verizon. And Verizon slashed the budgets for everybody right away. And about 6 months before I wanted to go on my own, they said, well, congratulations, you get to go on your own. We don't have a job for you anymore.
Oh, man.
And that was that. And, you know, it'll be 7 years in June, the week of the U.S. Open, that I've been operating Golf Newsnet as my one and only job. So we have a website that reaches seven figures of people a month on our website itself in the, you know, the months of the year where people care about golf from February through August. And then, you know, about half that in the months they don't.
Okay.
We have video content that reaches millions of people a month through various video networks. We have obviously our social channels do okay, but that's never been a huge emphasis for me. It's starting to become one. And then about 16 months ago, we launched Golf Newsnet Radio in partnership with iHeartMedia. And we're the one and only 24/7 golf talk radio station that's free to access on the planet, which is a kind of cool thing. And that's gone pretty well. And we have about 40 different shows from around the world and always adding and changing. And we found two or three shows at the PGA show we're going to add to the network. So less repeats on the station, which is great. And then in about 6 weeks, we're going to launch Golf Newsnet TV, which will be a 24/7 free ad-supported TV. It's the acronym is FAST, streaming channel on a variety of different streaming platforms. And we'll grow that over the course of the spring. And probably by June, we'll feel like we'll have it in a good place. But that'll be a mixture of original content from us, talk show content each day. They'll simulcast on the radio. Mm-hmm. And original content that we'll produce, content that other people have already produced, whether that's for television, you know, the shows you might see on a regional sports network like Monumental on the weekends or Masson on the weekends. Those are time buys, but you know, those shows have deep libraries typically.
Sure.
And they can't really monetize them after they first air. So we can create an opportunity to help that with other partnerships that we have. We'll have regular content coming in as well. And we'll do something similar that we do with the radio station, which is try to have 8 to 10 hours of fresh content each day that we rerun once or twice, basically.
And so you can pick up those shows, like an original show might air on Monumental or Masson or something, that for example, then after it runs that first time, you can pick it up and run it on your own, on your channel.
They can even run it with us first run. So what happens in those situations is interesting. So there are probably a dozen of these around the country. Some are regional, some are national, but they're time buys. They go to a regional sports network and say, I want this hour, or I want an hour. I'll buy the hour. In exchange, I can air what I want. I can air my show. I can air my commercials. I monetize that hour how I want. And the stations are fine with that because that's guaranteed money for them. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the folks who do this have done it for 5, 10, 15, 20 years. I mean, they're survivors. They figured out how to do it, how to make it work for them and their financial and personal interests. And they've developed this huge library of shows. And a lot of them are travel-focused. A lot of them are timeless. They don't need to be current. Golf doesn't change that much.
Right.
So they have these huge libraries of shows that they really can't do anything with after they air them. And some people I've talked to have literally said to me, I delete them after I air them. So we've been trying to find, you know, good content partners in that regard. And eventually, as we go along, we'll infuse more original content and take out some of the repeats throughout the course of the day. And that's probably a 2 or 3 year project to kind of get it where we need to be. But at least at the outset, we'll probably have 5 or 6 original hours each weekday. That's our stuff. Mm-hmm. 4 hours or so of someone else's. And we'll kind of blend all that together and put it out there on these streaming platforms that are growing pretty rapidly as kind of an alternative or bolt on to a streaming subscription or a cable subscription.
Interesting. So like someone like myself, just to put this in real world terms, like, you know, we cut the cord a couple of years ago. You know, I've got a Fire Stick. You know, I think I subscribe to Hulu, but the Fire Stick's got all these different apps I can download. Is the concept that this streaming channel would be an app that I can download onto my Fire Stick or my Roku Stick or whatever I have? Or would it be a part of one of these larger streaming services like a Hulu or like a YouTube TV or something like that?
Both, actually. So we have apps today for Roku and Amazon and Apple TV, and we'll redesign those as part of this rollout. I'm working on that now. But there are these streaming platforms out there that are like Pluto or the Roku channel or Freevee or Tubi or Plex or Zumo. There's Vizio, Samsung. I can keep going for a while. There are probably 8 or 9 kind of top tier ones that effectively have this, what's, again, it's called FAST, free ad supported TV. And that their app, their part of that platform is, we're going to look like a channel grid, you know, a channel guide. You pick this channel, you watch it, it looks like normal TV, it acts like normal TV, but it doesn't cost you anything. And there's a mixture of channels. Some are 24/7 reruns of God knows what show, Gunsmoke, Law and Order, Price is Right. I mean, go down the line. And some of them are, you know, intending to be kind of television channels that just aren't on cable. And we're going to kind of fit in that bucket. There really is nothing like this in the golf space. The PGA Tour has a channel that really just airs old tournament highlight movies, one after another after another. And there's really no one else doing this in this space. So I've always tried to be kind of a first mover in anything that I've done, because I feel like that's my only advantage, is if I can do it first, then I can establish something that the followers have to kind of build upon and beat. And that's why we've done it with, one of the first golf podcasts ever. Certainly the radio is the first kind of thing. And we're going to do the same thing with TV. And then I'll run out of ideas and won't do anything else.
That's interesting. And then if you're able to do, is there a name for this network yet?
It'll just be Golf News Net.
Got it. Yeah. And then will you be able to, like, if you download its own app, will the programs be on demand as well? Like the certain shows
you want? Yep. So it'll be a mixture of, hey, you can watch the linear channel live, or you can just pick and choose what you want to watch.
The show that I keep going back to in my head as you're talking about this, because it feels like it fits this category. I don't know if you've talked to him yet or not, but he was on this podcast. But down on the Eastern Shore, Endless Golf, Bobby Vermillion. Are you familiar with him?
I watch that sometimes on the weekend. I haven't talked to Bobby about it. I don't know Bobby personally, so doing that outreach, I've kind of saved for once
his
we kind of watch
like,
a little
cause,
bit.
Because I had him on the show. I didn't really get super into the specifics of how he ends up on, but I think it's shown on Masson.
Yep.
I
don't know where else he does it, but I know it's on Masson.
Same kind of thing. It's kind of timeless. It's not necessarily, you know, he's out with pros, usually on the Eastern Shore, just playing a couple holes, talking about the course. And it could be 5 years old, and you really, as long as they haven't done a course redesign, you don't really know. And it probably only plays a couple times. So that's the kind of show that I think in my head. And oh, by the way, I love that show. When it comes on, I stop and watch it.
Yeah, it's a great little Saturday morning show. Again, we're all sickos about golf, right? I am half convinced, and I have not had this conversation yet, but I intend to. I would love to talk to the people at Pebble Beach and go, hey, can we just run a show that just changes between your webcams at Pebble Beach for an hour? They have four of them. They have a first tee, 17th tee, 18th green, practice green. If you played that with full sound just for an hour, no commentary, no nothing, I swear to you, thousands of people would watch it because it'd be like, it's Pebble Beach. This is incredible. I get to watch it live as it's happening. You could do it at different golf court. You could do it at Bandon. You could do it at Stream, name your resort. They would love that kind of thing.
Yeah, I know Bandon already. Yeah, a lot of these courses already have those, you know, those streaming cameras up on their website. But that's like the golf equivalent of the fireplace.
It's the golf fuel log. Exactly right. And people will go and watch it because a lot of us will never get to those places and play. But it also is just kind of pleasant background noise and a pleasant visual. So I haven't figured out exactly how I want to do that yet, but that is something in the back of my brain that I want to go to those kind of resorts and go, hey, it's free pub for you. I mean, it's free marketing. And like I said, it's easy programming that I know people will watch, especially like if we did it, let's just say dawn. Like if we did it dawn at, you know, Pebble Beach. All right, well, we could do that for an hour. Why not? Would people would watch that?
Sure, especially if there's a lot stranger things on TV than turning on the TV and just having that run on the background while you're, you know, cleaning up the living room or something like that. So what about the radio network? Where can people tune into that? Like if I wanted to, when we hang up here and I wanted to listen to your radio channel, how would I do that?
Bunch of different ways, frankly, too many. But you can go to golfnewsnet.com and go to the radio page that has a radio player on it, a full list of our schedule, links to all of our shows. We have show pages for every show on the network, so you can go and find it and subscribe to it on your favorite service if you want to listen to it as a podcast. And that's kind of one of the goals of this, right, is to try to expose people to good golf audio, not just listen to our station. We know there are a lot of ways to consume it. Then on every article page of our site, there's a player. You can right at the top, right beneath the picture, you can listen to our radio station live. If you don't want to do that, or if you haven't been to our website before, you can go to the iHeart app on your phone, Android, iPhone, either's cool, and search Golf News Net Radio. You can subscribe to the channel. You can listen to it in the app. You can listen to it in your car through Apple CarPlay or Android Auto. You can listen to it through your smart speaker. Just tell your assistant to play Golf News Net Radio on iHeart. You can do the same thing on TuneIn as well, by the way. You can also, they actually have a TV app on iHeart that you can listen to the radio on TV. Don't know why you would do that, but you could. And then for our international friends, and frankly, you can do this in the US too, but we don't advertise it as much. But for people outside of iHeart's kind of domain, which is the US, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, there's one other I forget. But outside of those countries, we use TuneIn. So you can listen to us all those same ways. Android Auto, Apple CarPlay, app, mobile website, smart speaker. If you did all the same things except on TuneIn. And then for the only exception to all of this is Great Britain. In the UK, you have to have a radio license to be able to broadcast the station. So TuneIn does not operate in the UK. So we have a special player on our website just for our friends from the UK. And that's their only way they can listen is through that.
Interesting. I think this is kind of genius as well, because, you know, obviously I'm podcaster and I'm into podcasts, but all podcasts really are is on demand radio. And what you're doing and correct me if I'm wrong, if I'm misstepping, but you're kind of taking that and putting it back in reverse, because so many people consume media in so many different ways. And there's also just so many, we both know this, there's so many podcasts. There's so many golf podcasts. And, you know, we've all got our two or three or four that we kind of maybe listen to on a regular basis, but finding new ones and uncovering podcasts, it can almost be underwhelming. I mean, there's just so many out there. So the idea of just taking podcasts and then putting them on the program. So turning it on, like you would turn on like a PGA Tour radio and just listen to whatever golf content is there. And maybe you love it, maybe you don't, but you're just kind of listening what's being put on. I think it would appeal to a lot of people.
Yeah, I think it's worked out pretty well. I mean, the whole point of kind of bringing those podcasts to a radio format, and we'll take a 40-minute podcast, an hour podcast, whatever. We don't have a very strict clock, right? I mean, podcasts don't work that way. We don't work that way. But we'll take a show that's, you know, 45 minutes, break it into 3 15-minute segments, put a little commercial break in between. We're good to go. And The important thing for us is to make sure that we identify to the person listening when we take breaks. Hey, here's the show you've been listening to. And when you come back, here's the show you're listening to. And hopefully in the end, that leads to additional discovery for people. Because like you said, I mean, there's probably 300 golf podcasts in the English language right now, which is bananas to me. And some of them aren't active, but a lot are. And so how do you stand out from all of that in a world where there are probably 10 that get a very large audience?
Right.
And if my point of view is, and then throw in golf radio shows. There are lots of great golf radio shows out there. Some are national, many are regional.
I thought the number was higher than 300, by the way.
Maybe I'm lowballing it. I have no idea, but it's a lot. Yeah. And some have, you know, their very specific niche, whether that's a certain topic, whether it's a certain area. I mean, we have a show on GNM Radio. It's Utah Golf Radio. Yeah. I mean, they talk about some Utah stuff, but they talk about a lot of stuff that's related to anybody who would listen from anywhere. Yeah. So I'm willing to kind of trade off a little bit of local focus. Danielle Tucker is amazing. She's out in Hawaii. She does some stuff that's Hawaii focused, but most of her guests for her 90-minute show are national or international. So again, it's okay to have a little local focus, and we can have a national conversation at the same time. We could do both things, and hopefully that leads to, and has led to so far, a bigger audience for each of those shows that participate.
Is a goal, or is this even on the table at some point? And I'm only asking because I get it in my car. Sirius XM, obviously they've got PGA Tour Radio. Are they in a contract where that's the only golf channel they can have, or is that something that you could see down the road maybe getting on there as well?
That's a good question. I don't think there's necessarily an exclusivity around it. I mean, at least I've never had that conversation with them. Could we do this? And to be fair, we're only a little over a year into the concept. And they have their own programming that's really centered around, obviously, professional golf. A lot of it is professional golf driven all day, every day. And we have differences in that. I mean, we have programming on pretty much every topic in the game. So maybe that comes around someday, but I haven't pursued it yet. Maybe they'd be amenable to it. I have no idea, but it would be kind of interesting to have a golf channel that's not necessarily about professional golf.
Yeah. Well, it's all impressive, man. And going back to your original story of how you launched Golf News Net after you're losing your previous position to where you are now, I am curious. You know, you mentioned you've got, you know, 7-figure visitors monthly to Golf News Net, but that I imagine that didn't happen overnight. I mean, that's a challenging path. How long did it take to really kind of catch for you and you know, earn some real income?
Well, we had our first million person month, I believe it was August of 2019. Might have something like that. So, you know, that was almost 5 years ago. But to have consistently over a million took until really the post 2020, I think 2021 is really when it started to happen.
What year did you start? Or what did the
so
going back
first started story, posting yeah. in 2012 and first started full time in 2017. So
2017, that's right. Okay.
So building audience that whole time, I mean, it you kind of go from nothing, and there's a lot of learning involved. I mean, I do all of the programming. I do all the ad stack. I do, you know, I came from a technical background. I used to work in IT before I got into this for a living. So, I mean, I know how to code. I know how to build databases. I know how to set up advertising stacks, you know, those types of things that have probably saved me a lot of money over the years, just because good technical know-how is a couple hundred bucks an hour. but then to be able to figure it, start to kind of learn things that work with Google. I mean, I'm a one man band. I've almost always been a one man band, not currently, but almost always have been. So I knew that for me to grow, I needed to be able to come up with content that could be easily replicable in terms of week to week and stuff that people would want to know the answer to in perpetuity. So I kind of took two sets of topic areas and said, all right, let's answer stuff for the here and now every week. Let's answer stuff that people will want to know about forever and explain concepts in golf in a way that isn't just meant for Google, but is meant for the average person to read quickly and go, okay, I get it. Move on with my life. And hopefully the next time you have a question, you just come and look for me directly because I answered it well the first time. Mm-hmm. And if I didn't answer it well, I will fix it until I answer, you know, they present it in a way that it makes sense. So lots of ups and downs over the years of just trying to figure out what people are looking for, how to format it in a way that connects with people and Google, because that's a part of it. And then trying to fill in really now, starting in 2024, using this newfangled thing called social media to drive traffic, which we haven't done really at all in the 7 years I've been running this full time.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's a lot for essentially getting this all going as a one-man band, man. I respect the hustle. I respect the ambition and kind of their creativity and on how to make this work and, you know, creating a radio channel and now a streaming TV network. That's impressive. So well,
thank
well
you. I appreciate
done.
It. It's been very exhausting, but it's, I wouldn't have it any other way. I haven't figured out a way to fire myself yet, but someday I will, hopefully.
That's cool. I'm excited to follow along and see how it grows. Well, while I got you, a couple things. So I want to talk about two things. So one, there's the tour and professional golf is what you cover. And there was even, we're recording this on Wednesday morning, and there seems to be, you know, news around the world of golf and PGA Tour and LIV and the PIF and the investment happening left and right. And there was a big story just broke, you know, an hour before we hopped on here. And I just want to kind of get your broad perspective on things. It's the, what is it even called? The Strategic Sports Group just invested $3 billion in the PGA Tour in a new for-profit entity. I guess it's called PGA Tour Enterprises. And with the assumption that enables them to now come up with a partnership with LIV. And I guess my question or, you know, what, how do you react to that news? And then my larger question is, where do you see all this in a year from now?
I'll take the last question first. I really don't know. I mean, I feel like I've been talking about this a long time. I do a podcast during the weekdays called Two Off the First, kind of hyper-focused on big stories in professional golf. And this obviously has been a big part of it the last year. And I kind of saw the way this was going to lead to, which was this moment first of, okay, we've got the shock of June 6th and the agreement from May 30th. How is this all going to work out? Well, they could still get different money. They could use this to play against the Saudis. They could do a lot of different things. You could kind of see the writing on the wall. Just how exactly that was all going to happen was not clear. And then Fenway Sports Group comes in, says, hey, we'll take Fenway, our assets. We'll also bring in additional North American sports owners. We'll create this consortium called Strategic Sports Group, which on paper has a heck of a lot of money behind them, you know, 12 figures worth of value. And we will find a way to invest in the PGA Tour. And oh, by the way, we'll have the Saudis involved. But I think this was always a power play. Jay Monahan was pretty brilliant, I will admit. It didn't seem like it at the time, but it turned out to be pretty brilliant to get the lawsuits to go away by creating the framework agreement. And then trying to figure out, okay, now how do we get out of this with either just investment from someone else that's US-based or the Saudis or both and make it pass muster for the Department of Justice? And I think they're at the point where at some point they realize, okay, we've got a lot of differences to figure out with the Saudis, but I know we can get you this money from SSG. So they go and lock that up today. And I, you know, everyone's kind of aware that in these negotiations, where they stand, right? I think the Saudis now know, okay, they have the minimum amount of money they're looking for. Maybe they don't need us. Maybe they do. But a partnership at this point isn't just about the money if they do it with the Saudis. Mm-hmm. It's now about how do you bring it all back together and effectively don't compete with each other in a way that they've been doing the last year and a half and kind of nuking people's interest in professional golf. And I think that's the next step from here is, okay, we've established a valuation. Somehow the PGA Tour's assets are worth $12 billion. We've got a $3 billion investment from American money. Some of that's going to go to these players, a couple hundred players, in terms of a form of equity. Now they go to the Saudis and go, all right, well, we've got this money. We can do it with or without you. Do you want to do it with us or not? And that's whether this gets home or not. That's where this goes from here. Whether that works out or not, I have no idea. But the calculus seems pretty clear.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I it feels like it's tempting to say, well, now they got $3 billion. Why can't, you know, why does the PGA Tour need to do anything with LIV? But I guess the reality is $3 billion is still a drop in the bucket compared to what the, you know, obviously what's in the PIF, but what they're willing to spend, since LIV doesn't really seem to be concerned with a functioning business model that is profitable, more to just to get involved and have a seat at the table. I mean, do you think this, there's been a lot of speculation amongst golf media that this is the end result is going to be some type of world tour that will include stops in Saudi Arabia. Is that what you say?
I mean, I threw that idea out there in 2022 just for the PGA Tour, that if you wanted to create this kind of global series above and beyond the PGA Tour, that's what you would do. And in a weird way, it has kind of followed that. I think that discussion is still very much on the table. What I don't understand from the Saudi perspective, and I'll never understand because I don't have $700 billion at my disposal, but why would you throw hundreds of millions of dollars at Jon Rahm, another reported 50 to 60 million at Tyrrell Hatton? They signed Lucas Herbert, who was formerly a top 50 player. Adrian Meronk, who's the reigning DP World Tour Player of the Year. They didn't get nothing for going to LIV. They got some sum. So you spent somewhere in the neighborhood of, let's just call it $500 million to acquire four players. Mm-hmm. One obviously way more worth than the others. But if you get the ratings for this weekend in Mayakoba, and they're no better or not substantively better, maybe even worse, but I'm not assuming that, but if they're not dramatically better than they were last year.
It's still in the CW.
Do you panic? Right? Yeah, I mean, it's still in the CW, but do you... If you're Yasser Al-Rumayyan, do you panic? You go, well, we bought the best, we bought the reigning Masters champion and no one gives a hoot? What do we do now? Because if, let's just say it falls through. Let's just say there's no deal between the PGA Tour and the Public Investment Fund. Well, there's kind of been this chatter, okay, well, maybe they could just go buy the DP World Tour. Well, I got bad news for everyone who thinks that, because the PGA Tour owns 40% of European Tour Productions. So they own basically backdoor 40% of the European Tour. How are you going to do that? You're going to have to pay the PGA Tour a large sum of money to buy them out. So that's not going to happen imminently. If LIV just continues on in the background and no one cares, why are you spending money after it? That doesn't make sense either. At some point, Yasser Al-Rumayyan has to answer to MBS in terms of, what are you getting for this? Why are we playing this game? And I don't really know the end yet. It could totally work out tomorrow. Everybody has a deal and everyone who made the deal is happy with the deal. Or this could go on for 5 years. And both of those outcomes, I think, are totally possible.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the fear of all this is that, you know, people talk about, you know, golf becomes tennis, where the four majors are the only thing that anybody cares about. And that's certainly, I mean, you look at the winners so far this year on the PGA Tour, aside from the kid from
Dunlap, maybe.
Yeah, Dunlap. Thank you. Exactly. Aside from him, you know, I don't want to use the word duds, but I mean, there's, you know, it's not exactly riveting television when you see a leaderboard, especially the, you know, right at Torrey Pines, you know.
I mean, ratings were down 27% last week, year over year. And from 2 years ago, oh gosh, 40% from when Jon Rahm won over Will Zalatoris, or when Luke List beat Will Zalatoris. So, you know, the audience has faded some week to week, the regular events on the PGA Tour. If you got a star, it's working great. If you don't, this kind of thing happens. Yeah. One hand, that's great because you got to build new stars, right? You got to replace the people you've lost. But how often is Matthew Pavon, no offense to him, he's a great player, But how often is he going to win in the States? He might be a total one-off that never happens again. And that's the danger of an individual sport that has no connection to the individual watching it other than they care about the game or the players who win the most. That, I mean, that's why the Baltimore Orioles works, because you're from Baltimore or the area. You care about your team, even though it's not your team. Even when they're bad, they're still yours.
Sure.
But in golf, if Max Homa is bad this year, he's not mine. I don't need to watch him. I mean, no offense to that guy in particular. So it's a little bit of a different affiliation. And it really does rely on, just like tennis or any other individual sport, having the stars in contention, playing regularly, predictably. And golf's never had that except the majors. And now it's only the majors.
Yeah, and it's a shame. And the irony is that, you know, golf's never been more popular. I don't know, but never, but certainly not in the last 10, 15 years.
Yeah.
Since the height of Tiger. And you have all this going on, which is hurting ratings and hurting the popularity of the pro game. But you did bring up an interesting segue there, talking about the Baltimore Orioles. You're a Baltimore guy. And also, you know, we're recording this Wednesday morning, came across my news feed late last night that, you know, first we had Dan Snyder out as the Commanders owner. Now we got Angelos. Not quite as bad as Snyder, but he's in the same conversation. I mean, if you're an Orioles fan, God, Angelos was the worst. And you're an Orioles fan, right?
I am a very pained Orioles fan, but good news today. And you know, good news last night. I mean, I couldn't have been happier to see all the reports about John Angelos and the Angelos family selling. They got 10 times their money, by the way. They bought the team for $175 million. Now they're going to sell it for 10 times that amount of money to a little consortium, David Rubenstein, who's a venture capitalist guy, a couple other folks. Cal Ripken Jr. is part of the ownership group, so that's kind of a cool touch. Mm-hmm. But they're local. They're people who grew up in this area and now will control the Orioles, which I think is a really important part of the next step moving forward. And credit to John Angelos, by the way. I mean, he was in a weird position. He knew he had to sell because of the money he could get. And he did some things that were right to put the Orioles in a better place, not only in terms of draft picks and kind of professional level, executive professional level hiring, but then also kind of build the academy they've built in the Dominican Republic to try to attract talent there. I mean, they laid a groundwork to be successful that hopefully Rubenstein can take and kind of take the Steve Bisciotti approach from the Ravens, be hyper-local focused, just hire the best people you can around you and put a good product on the field and do what you can to do that. And I hope, I mean, I think that's what everyone kind of hopes happen. I think that's what people hope Josh Harris does with the Commanders.
Yeah.
And it seems like he's trying to go in the right direction with that. But
it's interesting timing.
But
it's interesting timing of the sale. I mean, everyone knew that a sale was likely going to happen, but the Orioles, they are primed. You could argue that they're primed for more success over the next 10 years than any team in baseball. I mean, they were, you know, had one of the best records, third best record in baseball, with the second or third lowest payroll last year. And they've got the number one ranked farm system in all of baseball. So exciting times ahead are in Baltimore.
Holiday comes up and is anything like people expected, man, that's going to be cool. I mean, you have windows in any professional sport.
Sure.
And the window probably for the Orioles is 5 years. And if they could, I mean, I was born the year they last won the World Series in 83. It would be quite emotional if they ever managed to pull off a World Series win. But like you said, they're in good hands financially now. They're in good hands ownership wise. They have their long-term stadium deal stuff in place. Whether you agree with the components of that or not, it's fine. And you've got a good personnel base at the major league level. You've got a great farm system. It seems all lined up for success. And then I'm sure it'll somehow hurt, but that's okay.
Yeah. Well, showing my age, I was at the game one of the ALCS in 83. It was the only game the Orioles lost in that ALCS against the White Sox at Memorial Stadium. But the other interesting thing with this news is it was kind of the Nationals as well, not to keep staying off golf here, but the Orioles and Nationals were both kind of rumored for sale. Everything was tied up with this whole Masson lawsuit. But the two kind of major players involved in both rumors were Rubenstein, and Ted Leonsis. And now with Ted Leonsis moving or the announced move of the Capitals and the Wizards to Northern Virginia and his kind of approval rating around here taking a hit, does he now make a move to buy the Nationals? We'll see.
Yeah, I mean, we could do a whole non-golf podcast about Ted Leonsis and how he has just absolutely torpedoed his reputation in this area, especially the last 6 weeks, but that's a long time coming.
But that's it. So let me get your take real quick on that before I let you go. So I grew up in Montgomery County, but I live in Arlington now and have for quite some time. And so that move was to my old neighborhood up until a couple of years ago, right in Potomac Yard. So the Northern Virginia fan base of both the Capitals and Wizards, they're not super upset about the deal quite as much as the folks that live in DC about the Wizards, but also the Maryland fan base. So someone who lives in Montgomery County, you told me you live right off, what is it, the ninth hole at Argyle Country Club. What's the talk in Montgomery County about the Wizards and the Capitals potentially moving a little bit further away?
I mean, I feel like from Monumental Sports perspective, from Ted Leonsis's perspective, he's tried to pitch it as, well, the fan base for our Washington teams labeled to be from Washington are from basically Northern Virginia and PG and Montgomery County and equal amounts. And then, you know, 10 to 15% is from DC proper, which I think is fair. I mean, population kind of works out that way. But I think the more people I've talked to aren't necessarily annoyed about the location so much as the greed of it. And the kind of middle finger, and you can dislike Muriel Bowser all you want, or the DC City Council all you want. You could have every reason to be upset about that. And there's plenty to be done in a postmortem about how Bowser and the City Council just thought this was a bluff. But he was the power broker until he decided to take the power move. He could have said, hey, you know, I just want to upgrade the arena. This is an important part of Chinatown, the revitalization of the district that's happened the last 25 years. Let's pump some more money into it. You know, we'll put a little cash into it. You'll put a little cash into it. Everybody wins. And now instead, you've alienated 50% of your fan base, at least, because people don't want to no one wants to travel 45 minutes to Silver Spring from Arlington. So why would I want to travel 45 minutes from Silver, you know, vice versa? I don't think that was smart. I don't think that was well thought out enough. And then from last week to come in and do his email blast about, you know, trying to explain all of his rationale behind it. And then to try to encourage people to put signs in their yard to support something that really only benefits him is.
Oh, I didn't see that.
Ooh, chef's kiss stuff. I mean, if you can go find it probably on their website, I think Leonsis also tweeted it out, but holy cow. I mean, that is the tiniest of tone deaf stuff that you can imagine. And you're like, and you're the guy in charge of these things? And if you buy the Nationals, how much worse is this all going to get? It's almost to the point where you're like, maybe the Learners don't need to sell the team yet until we can go find someone else to buy this thing.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think do the Learners care who the buyer is? I mean, I think Leonsis announced in his press conference that he wants a baseball team and he wanted it local. And I think he even mentioned the Orioles over the Nationals because they're the only ones that are truly local or local enough. I think the fact that his approval rating has taken a hit will just motivate him that much more to try to buy the Nationals as a signal to say, hey, I am investing in DC. We'll see. Time will tell.
I don't think he is the right guy. I'll just put it that way. I mean, I respect what he has built, but it feels like we've gotten to the point where he's drunk with power is the wrong phrase, but he controls a little too much. And I think this has kind of been a humbling moment about where he actually stands with his public.
Sure. Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting to see it all unfold, but listen, we're coming up on an hour here. It was fun to talk a little non-golf and it's always interesting. There's just a lot happening around the DC and Baltimore area in the sports world, a lot of ownership changes. There's a lot of exciting golf stuff happening over the next decade, you know, with everything that's happening, congressional, National Trust, and a lot of the USGA events coming. So it's exciting time, not just in golf, but in sports around this area. But I wish you all the best. Congratulations on everything that you've built with Golf News Net. And thanks for coming on the Beltway Golfer Podcast and rapping for a few.
Thanks so much for having me.
I don't have a good golf game, but I don't really care. I'm a regular dude living in D.C., and I want to know about D.C.-centric golf stuff. you can tell me something that I don't already know, then that is great for me. I don't want the regular stuff. I want exciting stuff. I want different stuff. I want stuff I can't hear elsewhere. But I want it to be about DC golf.